Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and today we're going back into looking at civil rights in America in the 1940s, during the Second World War and in the immediate aftermath. Previously, we talked about how civil rights advances had been possible during the war, normally as a result of presidential action and the threat of mass black walkouts in war industries as the result of discrimination in working practices. But now we're going to look at the legacy of Jim Crow in the South and the threat of racial terrorism that black people in southern states dealt with on a regular and daily basis. As we previously discussed, white southern racist thinking rested on the belief or the hope that society in the southern states was largely unchangeable and that the racial status quo would forever persist. And the idea that there could be any change was an almost apocalyptic notion. In the southern states, institutional racism meant that white power controlled all the levers of state, from the police to courts to government, and to the legal profession. There were no black lawyers, black judges, or black policemen. So from the world perspective of a southern white in 1945-1946, it was entirely conceivable that the South would remain unchanged. The only real threat, of course, was the Constitution itself, which had been amended at the end of the Civil War to grant black people the right to vote. But there were all sorts of methods to circumvent this. Poll taxes, for example. Literacy tests. And when those official means didn't work, violence, the Ku Klux Klan, and other forms of paramilitary and non-paramilitary intimidation. Black people were well aware that the local Klan members were normally police officers, judges, and jurors who would never convict or arrest a white perpetrator of violence against a black person. So the system of subjugation of black people had two arms to it. There were official state Jim Crow laws, and then unofficial paramilitary action that was intimately connected to the lawmakers and the legislation itself. One of the totemic ideas of white racism in the South was the fear of miscegenation, that black men and white women would have sex, and the ostensible racist assumption, the racist fear, I don't even want to call it a legitimate one, but the notion that mixed-race children would be produced, ostensibly, was the source of the anxiety there. In previous decades, various racial and eugenicist thinkers suggested that mixed-race children would be sort of mentally or physically inferior in some way, obviously a total nonsense, as the entire science of pseudoscience, shall we call it, of racial thinking is. But the irony here is that sexual relations between white men and black women in the South was a long-standing aspect of Southern life, and normally coercive or coercive sex or outright sexual violence and rape were the legacy of slavery, of course. White men insisting on sexual favours from poor and legally defenceless black women had existed throughout slavery, throughout the Reconstruction era, throughout the Jim Crow era, and late into the 20th century. So mixed-race children were often produced by these normally violent acts against black women. However, it was the anxiety on the part of white men that black men would be more sexually virile, all these sort of racist assumptions about black men, or would be more sexually attractive to white women. These thoughts existed within a set of racist myths about the idea of the predatory, criminal, rapist black male and the fair, virginal, unbespoiled Southern belle, whose honour must be protected at all times. Now, when you think about the things like the murder of Emmett Till, and we'll, as we move through this talk on week by week on civil rights, we'll look more at Emmett Till, who was a young black boy from the North who was visiting relatives in the South and perhaps did absolutely nothing at all, but supposedly the justification for murdering him by two white racists is that he made some comment or some suggestive remark to a white woman. The evidence actually suggests that that didn't even occur at all, that the person who accused him of all of this was lying. But his murder existed within the context of these views. Black men in the South, Emmett Till, who came from the North and was perhaps unfamiliar with the intensity of Southern racism, but black men who lived in the South knew full well not to be familiar or to make any kind of even friendly comment to white women for the risk of these sorts of things occurring. And whilst the overall rate of lynchings had gone down, there were 19 between 1940 and 1944, compared to 72 between 1930 and 1934, and 42 between 1935 and 1939, but the black people knew full well that any sense of them being an uppity Negro could easily result in serious violent retaliation. And of course, if any sexual impropriety was alleged against a black man, he would be facing an all-white jury, and there would be virtually no chance of getting any kind of justice whatsoever. And I think that part of the ideology of the constructed ideology of gender in the South is based around the notion of, or perhaps even in some ways, the myth of small southern white communities existing on plantations with large numbers of slaves, and once those slaves are freed, there is a fear that the tables are somehow turned, and that white communities live in some kind of siege mentality, some sort of siege conditions, surrounded by a sea of hostile black people. This is the fear and the anxiety that sort of manifests themselves in all these racist ideas. Of course, the reality, it was after emancipation, was far different, that black people were emancipated into poverty, and therefore, as a result, they don't have anywhere near the kind of economic power, political power, to organise and become any kind of credible threat to white people whatsoever. They're busy having to really cope with the legacy of slavery, and that meant for most of them returning to the kind of work they'd previously done, although now paid as small as possible stipend for their labours. The first flowerings of resistance in the South were there, though. One example would be the development of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a forerunner to CORE and the Freedom Rides. The Fellowship of Reconciliation was a non-violent pacifist group that believed in racial justice and was encouraged by the Supreme Court's decision to overturn segregation in interstate travel. So they began to test this in 1947 in the more northerly of the former Confederate states. Bayard Rustin, who led these efforts, was arrested, convicted, sent to jail, and wound up working on a chain gang for his troubles. Medgar Evers, in 1947, attempted to cast a vote in Mississippi. He turned up in his uniform, a former soldier, and he was threatened with violence. He was threatened at gunpoint if he cast a vote, and eventually had to flee for his life. But in 1946, there was a high-profile murder of 5 black people, 3 men and 2 women in Georgia, who were killed when they attempted to cast a vote. And to violent Southern racists, the logic was inevitable that if black people began to vote, they would begin to control the levers of power, and they would begin to be able to put their own representatives in office, and then white power and white privilege would be stripped away from white people in the South, particularly in parts of the South where they felt they were outnumbered by black people, and then the control that white people had in the South would be gone. This fixed world that white supremacists in the South saw in 1945, they believed was imperiled, under threat, and they needed to fight in order to control it. One of the powerful myths that the Confederacy had gifted to Southern whites was the idea that they were in some ways the embattled underdog, the rebels, quite literally, that they were fighting against threats to their survival all round, from blacks within the South and from do-gooding Northern Yankees who were looking to upend ways of life that they couldn't understand or imagine. That once again, the interfering federal government was meddling in things that were none of its concern. And Southern white politicians were adept at speaking in explicit terms to their white constituency about the question of race. Eugene Talmadge, for example, when he was elected governor of Georgia in 1946, said that no Negro will vote in Georgia for the next 4 years. And what he was explicitly saying there was that the South, that Georgia particularly, under his watch, would defy the Constitution. It would defy the executive. It would defy the Supreme Court, which is quite an epic challenge to the authority of the government. However, the fact that people like Talmadge gambled on this being successful was borne out by federal inaction up until really the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in 1964 and 65 respectively. What it didn't do was dampen amongst black people the desire for organisation, advancement, and the struggle for civil rights. Black people continued to register to vote. They continued to challenge discrimination in the workplace. They continued to join trade unions. They continued to present to the federal and Supreme Courts challenges to the Jim Crow laws. And they continued to use the U.S. Constitution and its amendments in order to...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Bolster their cause. I suppose, put simply, however savage and brutal white violence against black people was in the southern states after World War II, it was also ineffective. One key reason for this was a dramatic improvement in literacy amongst black people in the South. In 1880, 70% of black school children were illiterate. In 1910, that had fallen to 31%. And by 1945, it had fallen to 11%. Now, the story in the North is slightly different. Though black protest had been violently subjugated for the most part in the South, in the North, it was far more open. The Congress of Racial Equality, that was founded in 1942, was organising sit-ins that we normally associate in the South with like the Greensboro, Walworth County sit-ins. These were being organised in the North in as early as 1943. The first that is on record is was in Chicago. The Great Migration earlier in the 20th century of black people up the Mississippi River all the way to the northern states had resulted in large accumulations of black populations in Chicago and other northern cities. And this meant that there was likely to be, and indeed that it turned out to be, greater levels of black political activism in those areas. The NAACP, Congress on Racial Equality, and other groups forced the Chicago Tribune to stop negatively race-labelling black people in stories normally pertaining to crimes. By 1947... quite a significant achievement had been made in Chicago about the manner in which black people were represented in the media and the narrative that was created about black people. The association of black people and crime is a long-standing trope within American discourses and American popular culture and American news, and it was a way of justifying police violence against black people, and also a way of creating a sufficiently frightened white populace who would then be more than happy to listen to political leaders and public intellectuals that demanded that the government be more tough on crime, tough on black people, in essence. And at the same time, hate literature, the sorts of publications by things like the Ku Klux Klan, was banned in Chicago. This was perhaps quite an easy sell in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, that publications with racist or fascist views were seen as completely morally unacceptable, given the conflict that America had just emerged from. Now, a while back, I did a podcast on the growth of suburbia in post-war America and the racist politics and practices that surrounded that, particularly that of the restrictive covenant. The Supreme Court in 1948 said that restrictive covenants, which were private agreements used by white people, i.e. a white home vendor, a seller of a home, and the a white purchaser of a home, or a broker in the middle, that there could not be a secret agreement between those people to only sell to white people, or a secret agreement amongst neighbours that nobody in the neighbourhood, when selling a house, would sell it to a non-white person. These agreements were unlawful. And yet, white suburbia emerged nonetheless. And normally, when we're talking about the civil rights movement, the way it's taught in schools, I'm speaking here from a UK perspective, it might be entirely different here in America, that the key battlegrounds are always looked as education and transport and the desegregation of public spaces. But one of the first key battlegrounds, really, is housing. Black people who lived in overcrowded, poorly maintained districts in northern and southern cities were becoming concentrated there in record numbers, finding it hard to find decent housing. And the problem was exacerbated by banks and other mortgage lenders by the policy of redlining, which meant that entire neighbourhoods in cities, particularly suburban cities, would be blocked off from black people. Any black person wanting to buy a home in those areas would not be offered a home loan. Black people also had problems from the policies of developers who wouldn't want to sell to black people, believing that other white customers wouldn't want a black family living next to them. There was institutional racism on the part of city officials who changed zoning restrictions that limited low-cost housing and meant that only expensive houses, which were going to be affordable to white people who had access to better credit than black people, would it be built in particular areas. Builders that did build low-cost housing demanded public subsidies. They said that construction was expensive, and if you wanted cheap housing, then the public coffer had to pay for it. And local officials would often say, well, I'm not subsidising your building company so that you can build homes for black people in a neighbourhood for white folks who are going to vote for me. It was the informality and the secretiveness of these covenants and agreements and ploys that left the federal government with a difficulty in how to tackle it. And it was only really the federal government that could do anything about it. Interior Secretary Harold Ikes controlled the Housing Division of the Public Works Administration until 1946. And he attempted to promote some fairly liberal policies about race relations. But Ikes was confronted by widespread anger and hostility about the possibility of black people moving into white neighbourhoods. And there were limitations, even to a fairly liberal politician, to what could be achieved. And here also we see the kind of the intersections of class and race in America. Ikes feared the political backlash that would come about if he built public housing for poor black people in wealthy white areas. It was as much that white people didn't want poor people living next to them, as well as the fact that they were black too. There was the neighbourhood composition rule that was developed, which said that public housing for black people could only happen in areas that were predominantly black anyway. So poor black people had to be provided for in areas that were that had a high proportion of black people to start with. And here we see a different kind of segregation. There's an official legal, juridical segregation happening in the South. Parks are by law segregated between black and white. Now in the North there is a kind of a social segregation that black people have black neighbourhoods and white people have white neighbourhoods. And of course the economics of it lead to inequality. White people that are given credit and can afford to live in nice suburbia where there's plenty of space and resources get to do so. Black people who have to rely on public housing disproportionately, who are poorer, wind up having these housing projects build in black districts, predominantly black districts, and therefore overcrowding occurs, along with all its attendant pressure on resources and amenities. The Federal Housing Administration, which gave out billions of dollars in low-cost mortgage loans in the late 1940s, underwrote the suburban expansion of the era, the massive growth in suburbs that circled various cities, made sure that black people, also Jews and Latino people, were kept out of this process, and that it meant that the white flight from the cities, white people trying to get away from their black neighbours, were facilitated by federal government action, federal government loans and allocations of cheap money helped to create a de facto segregation in the northern states. And the birth of the ghettos really is a thing of the mid-1940s. Large ghettos within cities that became notorious for urban unrest by the 1960s had not really existed prior to the Second World War. They were a process, they were part of the process of white flight and part of the process of housing policy from 1945 onwards. If you look at the case of Chicago, in Chicago, the number of white people between 1940 and 1950 declined slightly, but the number of dwelling units that were occupied by white people increased by about 10%. So the number of white people declined by 0.1% in that period, and the number of houses went up by 10%. During that time, the number of black people in Chicago increased by 80.5%. This is mainly due to southern migration. They occupied 72.3% more units, houses, from flats and that kind of thing, from than in 1940. So that's an 80.5% increase in people and a 72.3% increase in property inhabited. During that period, the percentage of non-white people in overcrowded accommodation jumped from 19% to 24%, and the number of units that had no private bath facilities increased by 36,248. Now, the conditions were obviously insanitary. Rats were a fairly regular part of life, as were fire hazards. Between 1947 and 1953, in the Chicago slums alone, 180 slum dwellers, which included 63 children, were killed by fire. And the captive nature of the market for accommodation for black people meant that they actually had to pay more for the privilege. And rents were between 10 and 25% higher than those paid by white people for the comparative level of shelter. Now, I've got to throw in quite a lot of stats there at you today, and if you want to check any of them, you can look in Arnold R. Hirsch's Making the Second Ghetto, Race and Housing in Chicago, 1940 to 1960, which is an excellent read. I'm going to continue throughout the week with more on civil rights and the development of American society in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Hope you found this useful. Do check us out on Patreon, give us a good write-up on iTunes, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.